A group of independent researchers has found that the chemical crude MCHM is still present in some West Virginia homes. That's the coal cleaning chemical that spilled into the Elk River back in January out of a storage tank operated by the company Freedom Industries. The spill contaminated drinking water for hundreds of thousands of people. The research group was formed by West Virginia's governor after public pressure. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports on the research group's latest findings.
Samples taken from 10 homes across the affected area in mid-February showed traces of MCHM, with the highest levels at one home coming in at 6.1 parts per billion. That's hundreds of times lower than the CDC's short-term drinking water screening level. WVTAP project manager Dr. Andrew Welton notes the levels of MCHM in the homes are also lower than the state-established screening level of 10 parts per billion.
The public should feel encouraged that the levels that were detected in the homes are significantly less than January 17th and significantly less than when the spill occurred. There is, however, a low level of MCHM being distributed to the population from the water treatment plant. So there still remains this issue of persistence of this chemical in the water system.
In addition, recent testing conducted by WVTAP also indicated that MCHM wasn't present just before West Virginia American Water's Elk River intake. However, Welton says traces of the chemical were found in a nearby home, leading them to believe that the chemical was being added to the water supply at the treatment plant.
The results of that testing that we conducted for a different purpose actually helped us determine that MCHM was leaving the water plant but wasn't entering it, and therefore it's likely that it was a source of MCHM for the community.
Welton and Company then recommended the water company to collect samples before intake, after, and within their treatment facility. Ultimately, those results indicate that the filtering process was the source of the chemical continuing to make its way through the distribution system. Here's Laura Jordan of West Virginia American Water.
These results that we got back this week changed nothing about the commitment that we've made to our customers ever since January 19th was the first time that we, in my recollection, that we announced to our customers we will be changing out all of the activated carbon in our filters as soon as conditions allow.
Jordan says the filter change is a weeks-long process, with weather and other variables playing a role. Nevertheless, the company has been under fire for not acting sooner. Elk View resident Perry Dotson says he and his wife have experienced rashes, even after taking his doctor's recommendation to take baths in cold water.
I think the water company needs to be more aggressive in installing these new filters. It does not do much, very much good to be there 2 or 3 months down the road to finish, you know, that process. And I think they need to move quicker and faster to get those filters out.
As WVTAP plans to expand their in-home testing to a larger scale, they've charged a group of health effects experts to examine available toxicological research on MCHM. And while that panel is expected to release some conclusions this coming week, including scrutinizing the short-term drinking water screening levels suggested by the CDC, some, like Dotson, clamor for long-term medical monitoring.
Well, I think that's the bottom line. You know, what this stuff is going to do to the 300,000 people who have been exposed to this chemical now and in the future. And I think that's really the bottom line. You know, you want to protect your people from any particular problems that may occur, you know, and so if need be, set up some kind of monitoring system.
And Dotson may get his wish. A bill passed by the state legislature is set to require the Bureau for Public Health to conduct long-term medical monitoring. However, the bill awaits Governor Earl Ray Tomlin's signature, and a deadline for that to happen looms only until Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston, West Virginia.
Today, we are going to have a clearer picture of how climate change will affect the way we live. A UN panel has released a report from scientists who are getting a much better understanding of the effects of climate change. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports that it's not just about predictions for the future, it's also about how we should already be dealing with the impact.
Floods, fires, drought, war. These are the sorts of problems that scientists think might come with climate change. In the past, that's made these reports sound a little apocalyptic.
Historically, we've been the doom and gloom group. But one of the things that's really important about the new report is that I believe that we've turned a corner.
Chris Field is the co-chair of the latest study from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He and hundreds of other scientists from around the world wrote this new report. Since the last one, 7 years ago, a lot has happened. For one thing, climate change is happening right now.
We're seeing lots and lots of indications of changes in species locations or in fisheries operations or in agriculture, forest die-offs. It's really pretty dramatic how many examples there are and how far along the climate change path we've moved.
But scientists have also realized that it's very tricky to predict just how those changes are going to affect people. Extreme weather events are the pointy end of climate change, but it's hard to know where and how they'll occur. And humans can show creativity and resilience. They can adapt. It's that second part, helping humans cope, that is the focus of this latest report.
We need to think about managing risks in an era of deep uncertainty.
If you're imagining giant walls to hold back rising oceans, that could be part of it. But Field says adapting is more about building a society that's able to cope with unexpected weather and climate.
A lot of the smartest things to do are things that we should be doing anyhow. Improving public health infrastructure, improving transportation and communication infrastructure.
To understand what adapting to a warming climate might look like, take Bangladesh. In 1991, a cyclone killed more than 100,000 people there. That cyclone wasn't directly linked to climate change. But Salim Ul Haq, an author on this report who works in Bangladesh, says the response shows how to become more resilient.
We have built a whole series of cyclone shelters, done a lot of raising awareness about early warnings. And we've had several very big cyclones of similar magnitude in the last decade where, you know, the warnings were given, people moved to shelters, more than 2 million people were evacuated.
And very few people died. Digging shelters, telling people what to do when they hear a siren, these solutions aren't costly and high tech.
The rich don't have any particular advantage here. It's not technology that makes a difference.
In fact, Haq says that Bangladesh may even have an advantage. Because it's prone to flooding, it is more likely to feel climate change first. So Bangladeshis may actually adapt sooner than the rest of us. Chris Field, the co-chair of the new study, says overall, poor people will undoubtedly have a harder time than the rich in coping with change. But he adds impacts will be felt everywhere.
We see vulnerability from equator to the poles, you know, the coast to the mountains, big cities to rural places, and in rich communities to poor communities.
We'll all have to deal with a warming world. This new report emphasizes that it'll go a lot better if we work together. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Today, we are going to have a clearer picture of how climate change will affect the way we live. A UN panel has released a report from scientists who are getting a much better understanding of the effects of climate change. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports that it's not just about predictions for the future, it's also about how we should already be dealing with the impact.
Floods, fires, drought, war. These are the sorts of problems that scientists think might come with climate change. In the past, that's made these reports sound a little apocalyptic.
Historically, we've been the doom and gloom group. But one of the things that's really important about the new report is that I believe that we've turned a corner.
Chris Field is the co-chair of the latest study from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He and hundreds of other scientists from around the world wrote this new report. Since the last one, 7 years ago, a lot has happened. For one thing, climate change is happening right now.
We're seeing lots and lots of indications of changes in species locations or in fisheries operations or in agriculture, forest die-offs. It's really pretty dramatic how many examples there are and how far along the climate change path we've moved.
But scientists have also realized that it's very tricky to predict just how those changes are going to affect people. Extreme weather events are the pointy end of climate change, but it's hard to know where and how they'll occur. And humans can show creativity and resilience. They can adapt. It's that second part, helping humans cope, that is the focus of this latest report.
We need to think about managing risks in an era of deep uncertainty.
If you're imagining giant walls to hold back rising oceans, that could be part of it. But Field says adapting is more about building a society that's able to cope with unexpected weather and climate.
A lot of the smartest things to do are things that we should be doing anyhow. Improving public health infrastructure, improving transportation and communication infrastructure.
to understand what adapting to a warming climate might look like, take Bangladesh. In 1991, a cyclone killed more than 100,000 people there. That cyclone wasn't directly linked to climate change. But Salim Ul Haq, an author on this report who works in Bangladesh, says the response shows how to become more resilient.
We have built a whole series of cyclone shelters, done a lot of raising awareness about early warnings. And we've had several very big cyclones of similar magnitude in the last decade where, you know, the warnings were given, people moved to shelters, more than 2 million people were evacuated.
And very few people died. Digging shelters, telling people what to do when they hear a siren, these solutions aren't costly and high tech.
The rich don't have any particular advantage here. It's not technology that makes a difference.
In fact, Haq says that Bangladesh may even have an advantage. Because it's prone to flooding, it is more likely to feel climate change first. So Bangladeshis may actually adapt sooner than the rest of us. Chris Field, the co-chair of the new study, says overall, poor people will undoubtedly have a harder time than the rich in coping with change. But he adds impacts will be felt everywhere.
We see vulnerability from equator to the poles, you know, the coast to the mountains, big cities to rural places, and in rich communities to poor communities.
We'll all have to deal with a warming world. This new report emphasizes that it'll go a lot better if we work together. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Whale lovers scored a major victory today. For almost two decades, Japanese whalers have been killing whales in the Antarctic Ocean. The Japanese government claimed it was all for scientific, not commercial purposes. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that today an international court rejected that claim and said the whaling must stop.
18 years ago, the International Whaling Commission banned commercial whaling. Since then, Japan has allowed its whalers to harvest hundreds of whales a year for what it calls scientific research. Year after year, whale advocates in many countries called Japan's claims absurd.
Come on, look, this is not for purposes of research. This is commercial whaling in disguise.
Patrick Ramage from the International Fund for Animal Welfare was one who made this argument, to no avail. Today, Ramage was at the International Court of Justice in The Hague to hear the ruling from the court.
The conclusion of which is, hey, we agree with you. This isn't research and it has to stop. We had tears in our eyes. We're walking on air.
The court says it wasn't scientific research because, among other reasons, they didn't publish in any scientific journals or collaborate with other scientists. The court ordered Japan to revoke whaling permits and to stop issuing new ones. Japan says it's disappointed but will abide by the ruling out of respect for international legal order. The case was brought by Australia, and the ruling applies to the southern or Antarctic Ocean. That's where Japan has killed the most whales since the ban, about 10,000. The ruling also could affect whaling done elsewhere under the guise of science. Japanese whalers also kill whales off their own coast and in the North Pacific. Even if the ruling were to extend to all of Japan's whaling, there are still other countries that kill whales commercially without claiming it's for science. Norway and Iceland. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News. An international panel of scientists is predicting a long list of dire consequences of climate change over the next century. Spreading disease, coastal floods, suffering crops. And they say it's too late to stop at least some warming. This is the consensus of hundreds of scientists. But one of them refused to put his name on the final summary. He felt it was too much doom and gloom, and he said it failed to account for human innovation. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports on the disagreement over the report's message.
The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a grim accounting of our future on a warmer planet. Heat-related diseases are likely to rise, crops will be harder to grow, disputes over dwindling resources like fresh water might even lead to war. To climate economist Richard Toll, the report sounds pretty depressing.
It's risk, 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 and climate change is dangerous, and we're all going to die, and we're all going to starve.
Toll is at the University of Sussex in the UK and helped to write the new report. He co-authored a chapter on the economic impact, but he took his name off the final summary of the report because he felt it didn't accurately account for human ingenuity. Take, for example, crop yields. The report says climate change will cause them to fall by a few percent per decade. But Toll says technological innovation will likely raise crop yields by 10% or more.
So it's not that crop yields are going to fall, but they're going to rise more slowly because of climate change. And then, of course, it doesn't sound as alarming.
Now, to be clear, Toll still believes in climate change, and he still thinks it's a really serious problem. In fact, that's why he's speaking out. He thinks this report will work people up. Just when there needs to be a consensus on how to keep the world from getting even warmer, this report will move believers and deniers further apart.
I think there is a real risk of this draft further polarizing the climate debate rather than calming things down and moving us forward.
Richard's a great guy. I love him, but he's not in the center of the scientific community.
That's Chris Field, who co-chaired the entire report. He says Toll is just one of over 300 lead authors.
I don't ask them to all agree. What I ask them is to work together in a way that tells the world community what the position of the scientific community on this issue is.
Field thinks the new report appropriately cautions about some very real risks, but he does acknowledge that predicting exactly what will happen is difficult because people aren't like melting glaciers. They don't just sit there, they adapt.
People have a tendency of changing what they do when they realize they have a problem. That's the core essence of adaptation.
A big part of this new report is encouraging people to respond. It's clear that the temperature will rise by at least 4 degrees Fahrenheit this century. Field thinks improved transportation infrastructure, better disaster response, and healthcare could all help lessen the impact. But he also thinks too much faith in technology is itself risky.
One of the things that can create vulnerability is actually hubris, thinking that you're protected or that you're too rich or you're too smart to need protection.
In the end, these two researchers are arguing about wording, not facts. Both agree that climate change is happening, that humans aren't helpless, that we can adapt, and that unless we make changes to avoid even more warming, things will get a lot worse. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
A federal criminal investigation is focusing on Duke Energy and a North Carolina state environmental agency. A couple of months ago, as you may recall, a stormwater pipe ruptured and poured as much as 39,000 tons of potentially toxic carbon byproduct into the Dan River in North Carolina. North Carolina Public Radio's Jeff Tabiri reports.
The third largest coal ash spill in U.S. history has put an uncomfortable spotlight on the governor, a former Duke employee of nearly 30 years, as well as on a state environmental agency, which critics say has failed to properly enforce groundwater regulations. And a debate over environmental cleanup at hundreds of coal ash dumps around the country has been reignited. Beneath the headlines and bureaucracy are the many farmers left wondering whether the river they rely on is safe.
I've got cattle grazing on the bottoms and drinking water out of the river right now. They have ever since, and have been doing it all winter.
Larry Burnett has 400 cattle on his farm in Virginia, about 25 miles downstream from the spill site.
My biggest concern would be, first off, is it safe? And will it be safe for the next generation with all these deposits around?
He says fortunately the cows seem just fine. The rural landscape along the North Carolina-Virginia border is a collage of windy roads, small churches, and farms, cattle, dairy, soybean, wheat, and corn. They're here because of the river. So too is Duke Energy. When coal ash spilled into the water after a pipe broke, in went arsenic, selenium, and other heavy metals. The long-term environmental effects on fish, wildlife, soil, and even cows are not yet known. Will Strader is with North Carolina State University. He works with local farmers on pest, dirt, and water issues. His livelihood depends on theirs.
The biggest concerns that I had were livestock drinking from the river, irrigating with that water, having any kind of contaminants in it, applying it to the land, and also flooding of the river bottoms.
Despite a wet few weeks, no flooding has taken place since the spill. Researchers at NC State are analyzing samples of water and sediment taken from the river. Strader's colleagues want to determine how much water could safely be applied to the land.
Hopefully within the week, we'll have a statement from them on whether or not it's safe, but things are looking very positive right now.
One of those crop farmers patiently awaiting positive news is Jerry Apple. Despite the name, Apple produces corn on about 250 acres of land. He uses the river for irrigation.
If we pump something out there and it got in the land, and you know, it might cause problems a year or two down the road. And that's really kind of what we're worried about.
Apple says if the river is determined to be unsafe, he will switch this summer from corn to soybeans, which require much less water. That would cut his profits by about 25%. As farmers wait, the general feeling seems to be one of optimism, but
public perception is the great unknown. You know, how is this going to be accepted or not accepted?
Wayne Fitzpatrick is a Virginia dairy farmer and conservationist. He's involved with the Dan River Basin Association and has concerns about market prices of goods as well as tourism.
Well upstream of the spill site, we've already had anecdotal reminders that people are canceling their summer cabin reservations and their kayak rentals.
Upstream, there don't appear to be any legitimate environmental concerns because of the spill. Downstream from the spill, the North Carolina Health Department has advised people to avoid contact with the water for now. Fitzpatrick says it took just a few hours for a broken pipe and all that coal ash to change the complexion of the Dan River. He expects it will be years before the damage, real and perceived, is fixed. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Tiberi, along the Dan River.